has ever seen a better Dave Johnson impersonation either. Our next up is someone, be ready, okay? You're about to have a shift in the way you see things and people and the way you experience life. This gentleman, I think, has better vision than anyone I've ever met. His books are powerful and life-changing, and we are so blessed to have him here. He's a crusader of truth and freedom. Please help me welcome Cameron Taylor.
Wow, thank you for that warm welcome. They keep inviting me back and I keep coming. This is one of my favorite groups to come and be with. Because I did meet a few of you in the halls, and just to see your smiling faces and, oh, we got the...
No, we need you there.
Want me here?
Yeah.
Can I wander, or...?
Sure.
Okay. Well, I thought I wanted to share this year, as I've been here many years before. My newest book is called The Way of Aloha. So we're going to teach you some of the principles for joyful living from the ancient islands of Hawaii. And as I was beginning, I always try to start saying, God, what do you want me to do? One of the things God told me to do is to write. And as I said, well, what's the next book you want me to write about? I was very excited. And I said, I want you to write about the ancient principles of aloha. And in some of my studies, I found that there's a survey that's done each year of the different 50 states. And every year, Hawaii ranks as the happiest place of the 50 states and also the least stressful. Every year, they're number one in both those categories. And then I started saying, okay, there's must be principles that they're following that lead to less stress and more happiness. So who here would like to have less stress and more happiness?
Yeah.
All right, well, we're going to talk about four of those principles today. Right. The first principle is called living in the present. It was interesting, as I studied the Hawaiian language, I lived in Hawaii for a couple of years and have made many trips back, visiting with different kapunas, the elders there on the island, and having them teach me different principles. But if you study the language, there is no past tense or future tense in the ancient Hawaiian language. It's all present tense, and that is by design. Now let me start with a story from this happened at IBM. Now there was an employee there who made a mistake, and that mistake cost the company $10 million. And so shortly after this mistake, he was called into the CEO's office, and obviously not a meeting he was excited to have. He sat down in the chair, and he didn't want to be the first to speak, so he just sat there in silence. But the CEO didn't say anything. And he said he sat there for what seemed like forever. He said it was probably only a minute or two, but it seemed like an eternity. And eventually, he couldn't take the silence anymore, and he said, I'm guessing you want my resignation. And the CEO responded and said, are you crazy? I just spent $10 million on your education. I was teaching at a youth conference and someone shouted out and said, I'd like to work for that guy. Right, wouldn't we all want to work with someone like that? Because it's a different attitude. He didn't view failure or a mistake as failure. He viewed it as learning, right? And so as we start seeing that we're designed to learn by making mistakes. The great Olympian Peter Bittmar said this. He said, it's necessary to fail. That's how we learn. Now, who here has recently seen a new child learn to walk? Anybody had that experience recently? All right. What was it like?
Very, very exciting, fun.
So did the child just stand up one day and walk? Okay, how often did they fall down? Alright, so how many times do you think they fell down? Hundreds? Okay, so at any point, maybe after they've fallen 230 times, you just say, that's it. You're done. You fell 230 times. That's it. You're done. Just crawl already. Why don't you just give up? Of course not. See, we see it in that example of walking. We see how ridiculous that would be. But how often? This is hundreds of times failing. But that's how we learn. Right? But oftentimes in life, we may fail 1, 2, 3, 4 times. Like, oh, I'm just not good at it. Was the person just not good at walking? Oh, they're learning. Saying whenever we do something new, you're usually not good at it first. And so you'll have to make those mistakes. But we don't view them as failure. Again, when they fall down, when a child falls down, it's actually exciting to see them fall down. What's their normal reaction?
They laugh.
They laugh and they smile. It's an exciting thing. But what do we typically do when we make a mistake? Cry or mope or like, well, I don't want to do that again. But the child hop right back up. They're happy. They try again. Right? So I saw everybody here walking. So you've all learned that principle. Right? So we need to just now apply the same principle we've all learned in learning to walk to business and every other aspect of our life. Okay? So failure is a part of learning. Don't be afraid to fail. The formula for success is to try until you succeed. Now I'll share a quote with you from one of the Hawaiian elders. This was a principle that he shared with me. He said, to fulfill the measure of your creation, you are to live with joy. To enjoy the present, you must let go of the pains and guilt of the past and eliminate the worries of the future. So that's Aloha principle number one, is to live in the present. Okay? Learn from our mistakes, but live in the present. Introduce our next principle. Share a story that actually happened here in, just south of here in Salt Lake City. So I was invited to speak to a high security youth prison in Salt Lake City. And so I showed up on the appointed day and time, and as I arrived, I was impressed by the security. I had to go through many levels of security to even get into the building. And then once I was in the building, had to go through several more layers of security, I couldn't even take in a pen or pencil with me. As that, with my keys, anything, they said it could be used as a weapon. I was like, okay. So we get through all these things and get into the room where they then invite the youth and the guards into the room for me to teach. And this was a different experience. As you see, I have my notes here for my presentation today. I always try to ponder and meditate on what principles I'm supposed to share. As I pondered on that event, I didn't have any notes. I was only given two directives as I pondered on what to share. The first was, when you look into their eyes, I will give you the words to speak. And the second directive was, pray to see them as I see them. And as I stood up to speak, and there was just a moment of quiet as I looked into their eyes, all I felt was love. And I didn't see a bad kid in the room. I felt impressed to share something from my own youth, something I typically did not share from the stage. But I shared that as a youth, I was sexually abused by my grandfather, and that had caused all kinds of feelings of pain and hurt. And one of those hurts was that it hurt to hug people. My heart had been hurt. In order to protect myself, you get to where you isolate yourself from other people. Don't trust others, especially people older than you. And I shared with them in the stories that I share in this book about the power of hugs. Just when I love to come here and be greeted with hugs. But I used to hate being hugged. When I first showed up in Hawaii, I was 19 years old. I lived there for 2 years. I had more hugs in the first 10 minutes than I had in 19 years of my life. And I was like, I don't know if I'm going to survive here with all these hugs. Every time they'd hug, my body would just stiffen. And what should have been a moment of love and warmth for me was pain and discomfort. And as I shared that with these boys, I could see all their eyes were on me, and they were paying attention to these stories. They could relate, as they had all experienced some kind of pain and hurt or abuse in their life. But I said, over time, after hundreds and hundreds of hugs while I was on the island, and now hundreds of hugs I've received from my Nican family, I now love giving hugs. Their hugs are healing. You know, and after, it was a lot of hugs, but eventually my heart was healed. And I said, I would like to give each of you a hug. And you could see some of the guards were like, well, this isn't going to go over well. You could see their body language, but the kids were still. And as I started even making the suggestion, one of the kids came up and was standing right at my side. And I continued to explain, he wanted the first hug. And so I gave him an embrace. And I said, I love you, brother. Words that were, I wouldn't have been able to say, you know, decades earlier. But then I was still shocked. He squeezed me back and he said, I love you too. And it's still surprising for me to hear that. And then, without direction, different boys started coming up. And I embraced each of them. I said, I love you, brother. And they said back, I love you too. Each boy came up. And there was one boy who was hesitant to come up. But now we had positive peer pressure. They're all like, go up, give him a hug. And you could tell. And afterwards, I found out that he was in there for drive-by shootings. And had actually shot people. And so I was like, okay, that's probably not a big hugger. You know, but he saw what was happening. He saw the other people. And he felt something. He started to see himself as God sees him, not as the world sees him. And he saw something special happening, and he came up. And again, I gave him a hug. And he was a little stiffer, a little more resistant. And I said, I love you, brother. And he squeezed me back. And he was the only one who didn't say, I love you, too. But I could tell it was a step in the right direction for him. It took me a long time before I could ever say those words back to someone. But then they said, well, we want the guards to come up. And one of the guards was a big 300-pound Polynesian. And he came up. Mana is the word for spiritual power. I gave him a hug and I said, oh, this man has great mana, great spiritual power. I gave him a big hug and he squeezed me back, about broke my ribs. I said, I love you, brother. He said, I love you too. Then they got on their radios, the other guards, and they said, we need to get all the other guards here and have them get a hug. And they then said, there's this one guy, there's no way he's going to give him a hug. And they got on the radio, so the other guys started coming in, they came in, we gave them hugs. And then the one guy came in, and they said, this was a guard, there's no way. And he came in, and there were still some other guards getting hugged. And he came up, and he got a hug, and all the boys cheered. as he came up. And maybe he was in, again, I don't know all the background, but maybe he was one that was a little hard on the boys, or one that they just would see as the tough guy. But we saw that in that moment, a transformation come in that room when they started to not see themselves as the world saw them, or the labels that had been placed on them, but when they saw themselves as God saw them, and that someone else could see them as God sees them. And so that's Aloha principle number two. See yourself and others as God does. Well, the next story I'll share to introduce the next principle. While I was living over there, when there was someone who was negative or criticized, they'd say, don't listen to them. They're a crap. I'd be like, what does that mean? And I heard it a couple times, and one time I asked, I was like, what does it mean when you say that person's a crab? And they're like, well, when you catch crabs and you put them in a bucket, if there's one crab in the bucket, he'll climb out and escape. So you need a lid when you have the first crab, but once you put the second crab in there, you don't need the lid anymore. Because when the crab tries to climb out, the other one will reach up and pull it back in. And I saw that when I was over there. I was like, I gotta see this. And you put the crabs in the bucket, it's the craziest thing. And as you get multiple crabs in there, as one tries to climb out, the one will just pull it back in. And so it's called the crab mentality. And so when there's someone that is criticizing someone else, trying to tear someone else down, they call them a crab. But it's prevalent in our culture, unfortunately. And it's driven by envy. You know, that we see, if you strive for excellence, or you do something different, you want to get out of the bucket of what everyone else is doing, everyone tries to pull you back in. And as I experienced that when I was at Brigham Young University, I was studying at the business school there, and I was a slow reader when I started out in college, so I knew I needed to improve. So I took every speed reading course I could find, every speed reading seminar. I went from reading 200 words a minute to 2,000 words a minute by my senior year. I was reading 2,000 words a minute with very high retention. It's a skill that comes in very handy in college and as an author. And in one of my classes, I got the high score on one of the tests. And we were in groups, and people asked me, they're like, well, how'd you get the high score? It's like, you're rarely even in class. How long did you study? And I said, well, I had to study a couple hours. And they're like, what? They're like, I was at class every week, and I studied dozens and dozens of hours. And I was like, well, I did the same amount of study you did. I just did a lot faster. I was like, if I wouldn't have spent those 2 hours of study, I would have gotten an F2. I just now, as a senior, I could do in 2 hours what it used to take me 20 hours to do. I can read 2,000 words a minute instead of 200. And they're like, and I thought the question would be, oh, how do you do that? Teach me. Right? Because whenever I saw someone with a skill or attribute I wanted, I'd say, hey, will you teach me how you did it? But that wasn't the reaction. They're like, oh, you're a cheater. Like, we don't want you in our group. I was like, okay. So I got kicked out of the group. And a couple weeks later, I got called into the dean's office. So I showed up at the dean's office. I had no idea what it was about. And I got called to the dean's office and said, we have reports that you've been cheating. And cheating is an offense. It's a violation of our honor code here at the university, and if you've cheated, you'll be expelled from the university. And with that, I was like, okay. I was like, I haven't cheated. And so he did say, and they had reports from some of the students that I was cheating on these exams. And I was like, okay. I said, I think I know where this is coming from. I was like, is it cheating to learn how to speed read? He's like, no. I was like, well, I've learned how to read 2,000 words a minute, and that's why I can do things faster than some of the other people in the class. And so I explained that and convinced him. He asked me to read some different things, do some different things, and he was that okay. And I was free to go. So you see there, that was so when someone had achieved the degree of excellence, what did they want to do? Pull me down, right? They said, okay, instead of trying to raise myself up and say, well, how can I read 2,000 words a minute too? Which they all could have. It's a skill if they put in the time and effort. I said, the only difference between me and them is just time and effort. If they put in the same time and effort, they can accomplish the same thing. Now, there was other people that would come to me and say, oh, I got a test in 2 weeks. Teach me how to do it. I was like, it took me 3 years. 3 years of study and practice every day to go from that. So I said, I could teach you to do it, but it took 3 years of work, hundreds of hours of work to do that. So another example, how many here have been involved with the Pinewood Derby? Okay, for those who don't know what a Pinewood Derby is, you make a little car, has to be the right weight, and it goes down a track, and it'd be very competitive. And some of those people really get into those cars. Well, so with each of my boys, we've designed a Pinewood Derby car, and I've learned that wasn't one of my skills. I was just hoping all four wheels stayed on for the whole race. You know, I had a different goal than winning. But we had a gentleman in our church congregation that was doing the Pinewood Derby. He was an engineer. He had a brilliant engineering mind, and so did his son. And they worked on designing these cars. I mean, they were beautiful. And the aerodynamics, all that. I mean, he would go in and he'd teach y'all physics and wind resistance. I was like, it was amazing. And he won every race by a long ways. Now, what was interesting, when I'm over there with the boys and with my son's car, several of the boys started saying, Alex was the name of the boy that was winning every race. They're like, Alex is a cheater. Mm-hmm. And so I started going, I hear it and I go over and I was like, oh, why are you saying he's a cheater? Well, he's winning every time. I was like, well, that doesn't mean he's cheating. I saw him weighing his car. He's following all the same rules you are. They're like, yeah, he's a cheater. And I was like, no, you're a crap. And so I teach him about the crab mentality while we're there in a group. And they're like, whatever. But they start to learn that principle, to see that what was it? What was driving that? Why are you trying to tear him down as a cheater because he's winning? It's envy. Envy. It's pride. Pride from the bottom up. Often they look at those who are winning the race, and what do you do? Instead of saying, how do I lift myself up? We say, I'm going to tear him down. Right? Destructive envy. You said, I can't handle the fullness of his cup, so I'm going to dump it over. Right? But does the fullness of his cup change your cup at all? No. But often that's what destructive envy is. And we see examples of it all the time. A couple years later, I was visiting a friend of mine in St. George, and I saw a trophy. His son had won the Pinewood Derby. And I thought, oh, I got to ask about this. And I was still doing Pinewood Derby, so I went, what do I do? I said, teach me how you built a winning Pinewood Derby car. I haven't figured that one out yet. And he showed me the books that he had bought, the equipment he had bought to polish the wheels and polish the axles. And I was like, wow. And he said, well, I didn't know how to do any of it, but I got this book and I just followed what it did, and my son and I built a winning Pinewood Derby car. I was like, fantastic. I got a copy of the book, and we try to go through those things when we were building our next Pinewood Derby car. But I said, how many people asked you how you built a winning Pinewood Derby car? I said, you're the first. I said, how many people called you and your son a cheater during the Pinewood Derby? I said, many. And again, this is at a church congregation. You know, that destructive envy, we find everywhere. Okay? So here's a quote on it. It says, envy blinds you to your own giftedness and uniqueness. God didn't make you to be like somebody else. God made you to be you. Eliminate the crab mentality. All right, who here can tell me who Roger Bannister is? I know many of you heard me tell stories about Roger Bannister. Who's Roger Bannister? All right, yeah, the first one to run the mile in under 4 minutes. Okay, the record had stood at 4 minutes, 1 second for 11 years. It was said it was impossible. And that it wasn't physically possible, but that it was also dangerous to their health if they tried to run a mile in under 4 minutes. Well, Roger Bannister set the goal to run the mile in under 4 minutes. He got a picture of him crossing the finish line after one of his mile races. And he wrote on that picture 3 minutes, 59 seconds. And put it where he could see it. He then started visualizing every night before bed, running the race and finishing in 3 minutes and 59 seconds. Well, eventually, the day came for the big race, and he ran the mile in 3 minutes and 59 seconds. And broke a record that had stood for 11 years. The impossible record to beat. Now, what was interesting with this story was that 46 days later, Roger Bannister's record was broken. And when Roger Bannister was asked about his record being broken so quickly, he said this. He said, there was a mystique, a belief that it couldn't be done. But I believe it was more of a mental barrier than a physical barrier. Once he had broken the mental barrier, and the athletes had thought it was possible, it was now only 46 days until the next athlete broke it. And now there's been thousands of athletes that have run the mile over 20 minutes. But since it was believed to be impossible, that record stood at 4 minutes, 1 second for 11 years. Now I give the background of that story for this story, one of my favorite stories. So after you now have the two athletes, only two athletes in the world who have run the mile in under 4 minutes. And they said, we got to have these two individuals race each other. And they have the event held in British Columbia, in Canada. The stadium was filled with 35,000 people. They had it broadcast on TV and radio. And they dubbed it the Miracle Mile. That's that we now have. They're both at the top of their conditioning, as they both recently broke the 4-minute mile. And Roger Bannister said this. He said, Landy and I, so John Landy was the individual who broke the record, were the only two runners who have broken the 4-minute mile, and we're both at the peak of our training. There had never been a race like this. The stadium was filled with one of the most enthusiastic crowds I've ever seen. The setting was perfect. So these two runners line up to compete in the mile. And John Landy leads for the first 3 laps. And at the start of the 4th lap, John Landy has a 10-yard lead on Roger Bannister. And as they're coming around the last bend, John Landy looks over his shoulder to see where Roger Bannister is. And as he turns to look, at that moment, Roger Bannister passed him. And a photographer caught that moment. And Roger Bannister won the race by 0.8 seconds. The people said if he had not looked back, he most likely would have won. And now, to add insult to injury, that picture, a sculptor saw that picture of that moment. And he said that moment was such an amazing moment in history that he made it into a larger-than-life bronze sculpture of John Landy in bronze looking back with Roger Bannister right there at his shoulder. And that statue was put outside of that stadium in Vancouver, British Columbia. And John Landy was asked about the statue. He said, what do you think of this statue? And he smiled and he said, well, when Lot's wife turned back, she was turned into salt. He said, I'm probably the only person in the world that's been turned bronze. But look at that. So I share that story to teach this principle. Don't compare yourself to others. Just do your personal best. right? If he had focused on his race and doing his personal best, he would have won. When we start worrying about what other people are doing, comparing ourselves to others, it detracts from our own best effort, our own unique gifts and talents. We've all been given unique gifts and talents. We all have ways to make this world a better place that only we can right? And so as we start looking to say, well, how can I make the world a better place, instead of, oh, look at this person's gift, or look what they're doing, it then detracts from our focus and our accomplishments. All right, well, a few years ago, when my children were younger, we rented a movie from the library. And it was a cartoon, and it was a cartoon we had never heard of, but the kids picked it out. And so we started watching it, and it was propaganda. I'm watching it, and I'm like, wow, they had a superhero, but it was all about, you know, population control and different concepts. And I'm like, wow, that's interesting. I was like, there's nothing subtle about this. At the end of the cartoon, the superhero comes onto the screen. He says, kids, you can be a superhero too. Only have one child when you become an adult.
Oh.
Yeah. And that's what I did. I was like, what? I was like, and so it was a good time for me and my children to have a discussion. And so it's like, okay, there's two mentalities in life. You have an abundance mentality that you can build and create and grow. There's also a scarcity mentality, that there's a fixed amount of resources, right? And so if there's a fixed pool of resources, well, if someone gets more, well, then it means someone has less, right? And so scarcity and population, if you have a scarcity belief, and you say, well, if we reduce the number of people, then we'll increase people's prosperity, right? Because now there's fewer people to share this pot. So obviously the makers of this cartoon had a belief in the scarcity mentality. So we're teaching our kids about the abundance mentality, and we say, no, there's, you can have as many children as you would like when you get older and still be a superhero. But as I thought on that, I wanted to get real life numbers. That is it true? Okay? Is there evidence for the abundance mentality? I looked at the United States from 1960 to 2000. The population of the United States doubled during that 40-year period. Okay? So, if we had a fixed number of resources, what should happen to the income of the households in the United States? You have twice as many households, pretty simple math, right? Income should go in half. Well, you can look at the income numbers and those stats. I adjusted them for inflation. And so during that same 40-year period, average household income went up 77%. Right? So instead of going in half, it almost doubled. Right? So, but how's that possible? If the world is scarce and there's a limited number of resources, how's that possible? Well, it's possible because wealth is created. When you have an abundance mentality, you realize that wealth isn't just something that we have to divvy up and share. It's something we create. Right? And we see that example from, you plant an apple seed, well, you can now have hundreds of apples. Right? You take two chickens, and you can then get hundreds of chickens as you multiply that. We see that the gods created a world that is designed to be abundant. Anyone here run marathons? I knew in this group we'd have a few. Eh? Okay. So you run a marathon? Okay. Boy, you are so selfish. You know, that is just, that's one of the, I can't believe it that you do that. You have no consideration for other people? Yes, you don't even know what I'm talking about. Because when she runs that marathon, you're breathing a whole lot more air than everyone else. Right? As you're running, you're huffing and puffing, you're hogging all that air. What about all the other people in the world?
I was in the back.
Okay, so you weren't as bad as people in the front. You're so bad.
So we see with that how ridiculous that sounds when we get mad at someone for breathing more air. Why do we not have a scarcity mentality with air? Because it's abundant, right? There's enough for all of us, right? Now, is air created? Yes, air is created, and it's created in abundance. So the fact that she runs marathons and has more air than I do, well, I don't get mad because it doesn't detract. I still have as much air as I have. And if I want to go run a marathon, I could. I just don't want. Yeah? And so as we start getting that abundance mentality, and as we create wealth in abundance, we can have that same mentality. That we realize that by me creating and building, I'm not detracting from others. I'm actually creating and making the world better for others by creating wealth. We can create more air. We plant more trees, right? It's created in abundance. And that can be the same with wealth. So with all those stories tied to Aloha Principle number 3, which is live with an abundance mentality. So all those things, the crab mentality, comparing ourselves to others, they all go back to a scarcity mentality is the driver of some of those behaviors. So as you start living with an abundance mentality, you'll start viewing the world differently and start living with more aloha. All right, well, my final story comes from a friend of mine. Who here has heard about little giant ladders? Okay, we got quite a few. Okay. So my friend was an inventor. And one of his inventions was the little giant ladder. And a lot of people thought he was crazy. I mean, it took over a decade for him to really make it with the little giant ladder. And people said, oh, you ought to go get a job, because it's never going to work. And he's like, no, this is a concept that I really believe in, and I think it's going to work. And he stayed at it. And early on in the business, I mean, the business was now growing and successful, but it was still early on, and so he was still doing all the hiring for the company. They now have 800 employees now. But at first, he was still the one in charge of hiring, and they had one position open. And when he opened that position, he got a stack 3 inches high of resumes for that position. And his general manager brought in the stack of resumes, and on top was a resume, as he gave it to him, he says, you can throw that top one away. And he's like, why would I throw it away? He's like, you don't want to hire that guy. He's like, well, why wouldn't I want to hire him? He's like, because he was a police officer, and he stole stuff from people's car, and he served 5 years in prison. So he's not going to be someone you want to hire. He said, well, that piqued his interest. So he looked at it. He says, as I looked at this guy's resume, he says, I didn't see a criminal. He said, I saw a man who had served in his community. I saw a man who was a Boy Scout. I saw a man who was a father with 4 kids. And so I decided to call him in for an interview. He said, when he showed up, as he came into the door, he said he almost filled the door up. He said he was a big, strong man. As he came in for his interview, and we asked him different questions as you would in a normal job interview, and he said he saw in him a humility and a desire to work that he rarely saw. And so he hired him. And he said this guy was one of the best workers he had had. He got promotion after promotion and raise after raise. And one of the days he went in, he said he had a master key for the building. And he gave it to the gentleman. He says, you're going to need this with his next promotion. And he's like, what is it? He said, it's a key to the building. Opens every door, including my office. And this gentleman said, we need to talk. And he pulled him aside, where there's no one else around. And he said, he looked down and he was fidgeting. Now, Hal Wing, that's my friend that started the Little Giant Ladder Company, Hal said to him, he said, are you trying to tell me that you used to be a police officer
and you served 5 years in prison. And he looked up and he looked in his eyes and said, you knew? He's like, yeah, I knew. He said, you hired me anyway? He's like, yeah, I hired you anyway. He said, why? And Hal answered, he said, I can't even imagine what it'd be like having to tell my wife that I was going away to prison for 5 years. I don't know what it'd be like to be away from my children for 5 years in prison. So I can't imagine what it was like in prison. As a police officer for 5 years. And I said, I couldn't imagine what it was like trying to find a job because everyone just saw you as a criminal. He said, when you came in for your interview, he said, I saw someone who was truly sorry for what they had done. I saw someone with humility and a desire to work that is very hard to find. And so I hired you. He said, that man just grabbed him and squeezed him tight. Tears run down his face and said, thank you. Thank you. That man worked for him for 30 years and helped him grow the company to over 100 million a year in sales until he retired. And with that principle, that story is Aloha Principle number 4. View people by their potential, not by their past. As I was driving down here today, I was listening to a book called The Book of Joy by the Dalai Lama and a Catholic archbishop. Wonderful book so far. One of the principles that's in there that tied with the Aloha Principle is that one of the keys to joy is generosity. I'm like, yep, Aloha means love, generosity, abundance. All the principles we talk to are tied into that word. Aloha. Generosity. As I heard that, as I was listening, the thought came to my mind. It said, you should give everyone at the Nikkan Conference a free copy of The Way of Aloha. So I brought enough books for all of you. So I have some people that are going to help in the back, so they'll come and give you each your copy of The Way of Aloha. The key to joyful living is service, giving, love. So, thank you for your guys' friendship, love. So with that, we'll review the four principles we've talked about today. So, Aloha Principle number 1 is to live in the present. Okay, let go of the pain and guilt of yesterday, and eliminate the worries of the future. Live in the present. Aloha Principle number 2. See yourself and others as God does. Pray and ask that question. Help me see this person as God sees them. But sometimes the hardest person to see as God sees them is ourselves. So again, ask that question and see. Help me see myself as you see me. Hey, Aloha Principle number 3. Live with an abundance mentality. Alright. Okay, have any of you guys ever met a crab? Alright. Now you'll know what it is. It's very helpful. When you're striving for excellence, when you can recognize it for what it makes it less painful when someone's trying to pull you back in the bucket. And it helps you get out of the bucket faster and easier when you recognize that crab mentality. But also to recognize it in yourselves, because we all have that same tendency. So when you recognize, if you're criticizing or trying to pull someone else down, you're like, catch yourself. Say, no, I'm not a crab. I live with abundance. Okay, Aloha principle number 4 is to view people by their potential, not by their past. I wouldn't be where I am today if there wasn't people who believed in me when I didn't even believe in myself. Okay, we'll close with this final principle. That some people say, well, yeah, I would be, you know, less stressful and happier if I lived in Hawaii too. They say, so the solution must be for us all just to move to Hawaii. But there's people in Hawaii who are stressed and sad. You know, so when I was talking about that concept, a lot of people think that this stress-free living and the joyful living that's found in the islands was because of where they were living. And I was talking about this concept with one of the Hawaiian elders, and he gave me this important piece of advice. And this is what I'll close with. He said, Hawaii is not the least stressed and happiest place in the world because of where we live, but because of how we live. Paradise is not a location. Paradise is a way of life. Thank you.